Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and good afternoon, and here we are, December 1st, starting a new month, the end of the week, and for some, the end of an era. Sandra Day O'Connor, who was the first woman ever to serve on the United States Supreme Court, passed today at her home in Phoenix, Arizona. She was 93 years old. It was announced back in October of 2018 that she had been diagnosed with dementia. And in a letter that she wrote, she said that as her condition had progressed, she would no longer participate in public life. She spent 24 years on the bench of the Supreme Court, which allowed her to vote in some of the most contentious issues that the court had ever faced, including affirmative action and abortion. One of her most influential roles was in the 5-4 vote in Bush versus Gore, as she joined with Justices Anthony Kennedy, William Rehnquist, Antonin Scalia, and Clarence Thomas in the decision that led to George W. Bush's 2000 election win. And we all know how that turned out. 2009, she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom for her role in transforming the American judiciary, you know, paving basically the way for women to join what had only been the men's club. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan have also joined the nation's highest court since she was appointed in 1981. She had been a judge and an Arizona legislator, cancer survivor. She was born in Texas. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor, a lot of people used to say, is like a pilgrim in the poem that she had sometimes quoted, who has forged a new trail and built a bridge behind her for all young women to follow. President Barack Obama said at the ceremony where she was awarded the nation's highest civilian honor, recognizing her for both her journey to the Supreme Court and the role she played during her tenure. Raised in eastern Arizona, she wanted to be a rancher as an adult, but left her family's enormous cattle ranch, which was 22 miles from the nearest school, to go and live in El Paso with her grandmother from the time of kindergarten to the 12th grade. She graduated high school at 16, attended Stanford out here in California, where she earned both her bachelor's in economics and her law degree. Now, when it came to finding a job, that was kind of rough because you have to remember at that time, women were expected to get in the kitchen and cook and clean and do all those things that they did in the 50s, that men expected them to do. And she was turned away from one potential employer after another. She said she called at least 40 firms asking for an interview, and not one of them would give her an interview. It was like she was a woman and they said, we don't hire women. She told NPR in a March interview in 2013. She said that was a shock to her. It was a total shock. It shouldn't have been. I should have known better. I should have followed what was going on, but I hadn't. She said she was offered one job, legal secretary. So instead, she turned to the public sector and served as a deputy county attorney in San Mateo, California in 1952. From 1954 to 1957, she worked as a civilian attorney in Germany, where her husband was serving in the Army. When she returned to the States in 1965 and in 69, she was appointed to the Arizona Senate, serving three terms. She became the first female majority leader in the United States for the Arizona Senate in 1973. Her perseverance paid off, and she was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1981 by President Ronald Reagan with a unanimous confirmation from the Senate, replacing Justice Potter Stewart, who retired at that time to spend more time with his grandchildren. She said she felt a special responsibility as the first woman in the Supreme Court. She said she could either do an adequate job so that it would be possible for other women to be appointed without people saying, "Oh, see, a woman can't do it." So it became very important that I did it in a way that wouldn't provide some reason or cause not to have more women in the future. Again, this was when she was speaking with NPR. Not even cancer could stand in her way. The best example of her tenacity, she underwent a mastectomy in October in 1988 for malignancy discovered at an early age. In a statement from court person Tori House, O'Connor said, "The prognosis is a total recovery. I do not anticipate missing any oral argument." And you know what? She didn't. She did not. Whenever it went down, she was there. This was during the time when conservatives were just what they were, conservatives, but they were not like these so-called conservatives today. It wasn't about playing games and getting up there and posturing for cameras and all this and yelling and screaming. It was about doing the business of the country. And that's what them old school Democrats and old school conservatives stuck to, doing the business of the country. Not to say that we didn't have some characters, because we did, but she definitely was not one of them. Now, she was what they called a moderate conservative. She was labeled a swing voter by many, as she often cast a deciding vote in high-profile cases. When it came to abortion, O'Connor started out as an opponent of it, but tended to side with liberal justices later in her tenure. In her first major abortion case in 1983, she dissented when the majority vote to strike down an Ohio ordinance that prevented a doctor from performing an abortion on a minor under 15 without consent of a parent or a court order. The state interest in potential human life is extant through pregnancy, she wrote, and a dissident that pleased anti-abortion activists. However, in 1992, O'Connor cast a decisive vote to uphold the court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, which had made abortion legal nationwide. She broke with her conservative members of the court in the Planned Parenthood v. Casey in the case, which solidified the foundation on which Roe was built on, while also expanding the authority to regulate it. That's partly why I was hopeful to, you know, hopefully we can get back to this, where the courts can think with an open mind and not try to control the nation based on what the party is thinking. Because right now, the Supreme Court is far from what it ought to be. It has become just another arm of Republican governing. And instead of truly taking care of the nation's business and handling cases like they should, it becomes, let me side with the party I hang with or the party that's paying me off, and seeing how you have all these conservative judges there now, they are mostly doing the bidding of the Republican Party as much as they can. The court has a long way to go to get back to where they were. Will they make it? who knows? You know, to be honest, who knows? Right now, they are at wit's end with the things that they've been doing. And whether people want to admit it or not, they're not at a good place. Now, they came up with this little thing that they were going to put together bylaws to make sure that they do things decent and in order. But as of yet, they're not really doing things decent and in order. That's just not happening with them. So, who knows what's going to happen with our courts right now? Then, if that wasn't enough, on top of that, today, out of the state of New York, freshman newbie George Santos was expelled from the House of Representatives. That's right, folks. Mr. I Will Not Resign was shown the door. And for those of you who want to say the Democrats could, no. There was no need for the Democrats to attempt to try to save Georgie Porgy, because the bottom line is most of Georgie Porgy's problem came from his own people. And the fact that he had 23 indictments out there, and he had done some very, very foul things. Now, there are a lot of people yelling and screaming that he was being judged without having been tried. But George Santos went out of his way to get himself in trouble. You've heard me say that. I believe he sat down, watched that old film, The Distinguished Gentleman, starring Eddie Murphy, as kind of like this street hustling guy who got into politics and used the name of a very well-known politician who had kind of passed away and got elected and started doing some way out things. And unlike the character in the Eddie Murphy movie, George Santos never did make a turn to try to do something right. Now, when they had his little hearing yesterday and things of that nature, his closing argument for the remainder being a member of the House, he was defiant. He depicted himself as the victim of a smear campaign by some of his colleagues and made it clear that he would not resign before a vote on this Friday on whether he should be expelled. Now, he became the sixth member of the House to have been ousted by his colleagues. And the thing about it is, he should have caught the hint when he survived those two earlier expulsion efforts, because that should have been his wake-up call. The House Ethics Committee had a report that was released on November 16th and had convinced more members that his actions merited the House's most severe punishment. Santos said Thursday, "I will not stand by quietly. The people of the 3rd District of New York sent me here, and if they want me out, you're going to have to go silence those people and go take the hard vote." It wasn't so much of silencing those people. Again, he put himself behind the eight ball. Now, of the previous folks who got expelled in the House, three were expelled for disloyalty to the Union during the Civil War. Two were expelled for lawmakers convicted in federal court. Santos appealed to those lawmakers who worry a new president is being set for the chamber's harshest punishment. This will haunt them in the future, where mere allegations are sufficient to have members removed from office. When duly elected by the people in their representative states and districts, he said during a press conference earlier that morning, Thursday, before, you know, the debate began. Now, he was a bright spot for the GOP when he won his election in November 22, flipping a seat that had been held by the Democrats and helping the Republicans take control of the House. But soon after, reports began to emerge that Santos lied about his Jewish ancestry, lied about having a career at a top Wall Street firm and a college degree, and he turned into a distraction and embarrassment for his party. And that in itself, people, is the truth. That started this march, and he started it. In early March, the Ethics Committee announced it was launching an investigation into him. And that followed in May when the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York unveiled a 13-count federal indictment that was later replaced with a 23-count indictment. They alleged that he stole identities of campaign donors, then used those credit cards to make tens of thousands of dollars of unauthorized charges. Federal prosecutors say Santos, who has pleaded not guilty, wired some of that money to his personal bank account and used the rest to pad his campaign coffers. Now, people, I'm not even a politician. I'm not even trying to run for office. And I know none of that is the right thing to do. So then, the Ethics Committee investigators spent 8 months on his case, and the panel then said it amounts overwhelming evidence of lawbreaking by Santos that it sent to the Justice Department. Among other things, the panel said he knowingly caused his campaign committee to file false or incomplete reports with the Federal Election Commission, used campaign funds for personal purposes, and violated Ethics in Government Act with his financial disclosure statements. That disgraceful association that comes with expulsion, not lost on Santos, but rather than seek to avoid it by resigning, he sought to frame it as unfair persecution, saying, if I leave, they win. If I leave, the bullies take place. This is bullying. No, buddy, it wasn't bullying. It was you doing a bozo no-no, pulling the stupidest stunts that you could think of under the guise of being sitting congressperson. Now, he comes from the 3rd District of New York, and members of the Republican delegation from New York were the ones who led the arguments for expelling Santos. Representative Anthony D. Esposito out of New York acknowledged that the expulsion would set a new precedent, but that he was confident that the American people would welcome lawmakers being held to a higher standard. He said that he was pretty confident that the American people would applaud it. I'm pretty confident that the American people expect that, and I hope tomorrow, and he meant Friday, in this great chamber, we set that precedent. Arguing against expulsion, Representative Clay Higgins out of Louisiana said that while he respects the Ethics Committee, he has concerns about how the Santos case was handled. He said he was troubled that a Republican-led committee would submit a report that was so judgmental and publicized. Excuse me, but why shouldn't it be publicized? Because I can guarantee you, Mr. Higgins, had that been a Democrat, you would have had no problem with the information being put out. He then said that the totality of circumstances appeared to be biased. Higgins said it stinks of politics, and I oppose this action in every way. Well, considering that Higgins comes from Louisiana, the home of one of the biggest political criminals, Huey P. Long, who was a governor in Louisiana and a crooked, corrupt governor in Louisiana. I'm not surprised by Clay Higgins' You know, because he's one of those Freedom Caucus cats, which means the dirt they do is what they're down to do. So I'm not surprised that he would feel that way. Now, while the Ethics Committee does have a Republican chairman, its membership is evenly divided. Republican Susan Weil, a ranking Democrat on the committee, reminded members that the decision approving investigation findings were unanimous. As the Ethics Committee report lays out in thorough detail, Mr. Santos repeatedly, egregiously, and brazenly violated the public trust. Mr. Santos is not a victim. He is a perpetrator of a massive fraud on his constituents and the American people. That's what Ms. Weil said, and she stood by her words. In his press conference, Santos assailed the Ethics Committee report as littered in hyperbole, littered in opinion. He emphasized the decision by the committee to submit the report to the House without making recommendations on punishment. Submitting a recommendation would have required a longer, childlike process, changing the precedent for me. It seems that it's all fair game, Santos said. He did not want to realize that he himself had put the bullseye on his back. And, of course, lo and behold, this Friday, he was expelled in a historic vote following these investigations. There were 311 votes to remove him, with 114 votes against and two votes voting present, to which he grabbed his coat and left the floor before the vote was concluded. When asked for his reaction following the results, Santos said, "It's over." What reaction? You know, as we said, he survived one expulsion attempt last month, an effort pushed forth by his New York colleagues, before formally convicted of a crime. However, a number of votes are expected to flip against him after that report, and that's probably what happened, because it came out he spent money on things like Botox, luxury shopping, and watching adult content on OnlyFans, which is an adult website. Now, what the man do is his business. But spending money that isn't his is not his business. So following this vote, Santos' seat would immediately be vacated, and the already slim majority that the Republicans have under House Speaker Mike Johnson will narrow further. Now, there will be a special election to fill that seat in the competitive district will likely happen in the next 3 months. Johnson and other members of the GOP leadership, excluding Steve Scalise and Elsie Stefanik, voted against his expulsion. But before Santos was even sworn in, a steady stream of media reports began last December, revealing that he had misled voters on every aspect of his life during the campaign. And the thing about that is, doing things of that nature, how did he not think that this eventually was going to catch up with him? I mean, he even did stuff like saying that he had received messages from Kristen Sinema, who was a Democrat and became an independent, telling him to hang in there during the 2022 State of the Union address, which her office said was a lie. They had never spoken. So, wow, this guy. So now that he is former Congressman George Santos, I really wonder what his game plan is going to be next. Now, rumor is that he said that he was going to start snitching on people, that he knew some things. My question is, will that carry any weight? And what is it that he knows? Because my thing is this. If you knew some things, looked like to me, you would have spoke out about this when all of this was going on right there in front of everybody. When they were doing these reports and searching into your background, looked like you would have put your hand up and said, excuse me, I have something to say. I know about this, this, that, and the other. But Georgie Porgy didn't do that. So, what's going to happen next? Now, rumor is that even though he's been expelled from the house, Georgie can still use the gym. Georgie can still use the cafeteria. I think Georgie still has parking privileges. But what good is all of that when you cannot actually do the job that you were voted in to do, and that apparently you were voted in to do and you decided you weren't going to do? Because let's just face it, this was just another grift at a higher level. And you got to Washington and got caught up in the limelight. You got to sit next to Lauren Bobet and Marjorie Taylor Greene and have little giggle moments with them. But the thing about it is, for the moment, they're still there. And now you're peeking through a window saying, wow, where did I go wrong? Yeah, George, where did you go wrong, buddy? Because now your ex-Congressman, George Santos. Yes, indeed. To think that some people burn a bridge behind them that they really need to leave up, because never know when they're going to have to go back across it. Never know when they're going to have to go back across it. Then Fox decided they were going to have what they called the red and blue debate. Ron DeSantis, out of the swampy state of Florida, versus Gavin Newsom, the golden boy from the great state of California, out there in the West. You know, those of us out in the West, all us yuppie vegan type folks, you know, we believe in the climate and, you know, trying to preserve nature. While Ron DeSantis and his folks believe in gas guzzling cars, draining the swamp, and eating everything from fried butter to gator tail. But last night, these two men met on stage. From what I understand, the throwdown was in Georgia. And Sean Hannity, of all people, was the so-called moderator. Now, it was on Fox News. And the one thing I did appreciate was what Gavin said at the end. And that was that he and DeSantis had one thing in common. Neither one of them were going to be on the ballot in 2024. And I'm going to tell you, I love that statement. And I love the look on Ron's face. He can try to play it off all he wants to, but the truth was right there. Boom. That was truly a mic drop. Now, you couldn't get more different in the approach to these two guys. Newsom and DeSantis. You know, both come from states that are very populous. Both are in their second terms. And both were reelected by large margins. And unlike 45 and Biden, both are solidly under the age of 75. Newsom is 56, DeSantis is 45. But apart from that, they definitely lead their states in different directions. You know, and that word freedom means something definitely different to both of them. Now, whether people want to admit it or not, DeSantis tried to make a big deal about the fact, well, many people are leaving California and coming to Florida. Yeah, there are people leaving California and going to Florida, just like there are people leaving Florida in droves and coming to California. Used to be they'd run to Texas, but then they realized Texas was just Florida light, and they kept pushing. They'd hit Arizona and realize Arizona was definitely not the place to be. So what did they do? Loaded the truck up, moved on out to Beverly Hills. They rolled into California. And yes, U-Haul will tell you that more folks in Florida are heading to California. Now, I can tell you one of the big draws of Florida. Florida is like Texas. No state tax. You know, less suffering taxes and regulations. You know, pretty much they let you run wild down there in Florida. But one thing is a fact. Can do a little bit better. Now, when it came to COVID, there was a big contrast in how that was governed and how that was dealt with. In Florida, the approach they took, there were fewer restrictions, shorter lockdowns, allowed businesses and schools to stay open longer, but they sure didn't line up a bunch of refrigerated trucks and move out a whole lot of bodies, just like they did in the state of New York and that they did in the state of Texas. Yes, Newsom shut down schools. We had mask mandates. We had people covering up. But we didn't get hit as hard as the state of Florida. And the one thing about our schools, this year, DeSantis signed into law universal school choice that will give parents the option to send their children to private schools or homeschool them with financial help from the state. Well, we don't do that in California. I can tell you that now. We don't have a bill that attacks folks. We don't have a don't say gay bill. We're not fighting with it. Them folks that run the house of the mouse. Because Disneyland and California get along real good. It's one of our top employers. We ain't going after them like DeSantis is going after Disney World, the number one employer in the state of Florida. But that's all about DeSantis wanting to take over and run things. Let somebody else build it up. Let me come in and take it over. The guy that he can say all he wants to about 45, but in a lot of ways, he wants to be a miniature version of 45. There are those at Fox who will tell you that, oh, yeah, Ron did so great. He beat that guy from California down. The devil is a lie. He did not. He did not. He got his hat handed to him. He really, really, really. Yeah. That beat like a rented mule. And what is it with this guy smiling? I mean, damn. I've never seen someone who it's like him trying to smile is like an attack on his face. It is like absolutely crazy. The dude fights hard to not smile. And when he does, it just looks so unnatural. But yeah, that was the debate in a nutshell. That debate wasn't really a debate. It was just one man making sense and one man speaking rhetoric. Now, another thing that has come up is the fact that people are talking about 45 having a get out of free jail card. Well, we can cancel that because judge ruled Friday that he does not have immunity from criminal prosecution or criminal charges for actions he took as president. Judge Tanya Chutugan found no legal basis for concluding that he cannot face criminal charges once they are no longer in office. And that was one of the things that he was bidding on, 45 was bidding on. Hence the reason why he's running for president. He figures if he's president, he won't have to face charges. No. Right now, he does not have a lifelong get out of free card. That's what the judge wrote in her ruling. As we all know, he is the first current or former president to face criminal charges. And her ruling is the first by a U.S. court affirming that presidents can be charged with crimes like any other citizen. And I love the fact that it's being put out there, because a lot of people believed, hey, let him run for president, he'll be safe. No, not at all. Now, Todd Blanche, who's a lawyer for 45, declined to comment on the ruling. And that ruling brings him a step closer to facing a jury on charges that he plotted to interfere in the counting of electoral votes and obstruct Congress certification of Biden's victory. He has pleaded not guilty and accused prosecutors of attempting to damage his campaign. You know, when the truth of the matter is, he's damaged his own campaign. This man, for whatever it is, does not believe in the rule of law and thinks the law does not apply to him, that he can do whatever, which is why he is in the situation he is in. 45 is one of those folks who figure because he has a little money, he can do what he want, when he want, and just overlook it and get out of it. But those days are coming to an end. Those days are coming to an end. And he's going to have to be held in account like everyone else. Those free passes that he got for some of the things he's done, no. It is coming to an end, people. And it is time for guys who have money to be held in account just like everybody else. Because we all know folks with big, long money always think that whatever is going on, it doesn't apply to me. I got big money. I can buy a judge. I can buy a jury. You know, some of them think like that. Something else popped up, and I'm trying to figure out how it plays on the landscaping. That is that a gentleman whose last name is Fisher, he's co-founder of a chapter of Black Lives Matter in Rhode Island, who has come out and expressed his support for 45's 2024 presidential election campaign. Now, people have been trying to reach out to him to find out if this is true, but apparently he reiterated those views, in an interview on November 28th, saying he expressed support for conservative views before. And he is calling the January 6th rioters political prisoners and said he stands in solidarity with them and that he supports the members of the Proud Boys who participated in the Capitol riots. He said their lambs led to slaughter to be sacrificed, an example for all who might want to be dissidents in the future. Now, his ties to the wider Black Lives Movement doesn't necessarily mean that others in the movement agree with him. They have been described largely by the Library of Congress as a largely decentralized network of activists in the U.S. and around the world with no formal hierarchy. The hashtag Black Lives Matter was originated in 2013 by three black organizers, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tomiti. The movement describes itself as a member-led global network of more than 40 chapters. And as you guys know, different chapters will do different things. And for this guy in Rhode Island to decide to march under the banner of Black Lives Matter, but yet support things that don't really have a Black Lives tie is kind of crazy to me. So I'm trying to figure out where that one is coming from. Now, recently, Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee voted Thursday to subpoena a wealthy donor and a legal activist with ties to conservative Supreme Court justices after the partisan bickering ended with Republicans storming out of the hearing as the final vote was being tallied. Republicans on the panel slammed the move as political theater and accused the 11 Democrats of violating committee rules. Democrats requested details of gifts, transportation, lodging, travel, and private club access provided to these justices by billionaire donor Harlan Crow, who specifically donates to the GOP, that appear to have ties in some cases to conservative legal activist Leonard Leo. They moved forward with their subpoenas after concluding neither Crow nor Leo were willing to voluntarily provide the information that they'd been seeking. Crow is a Texas-based real estate developer, has been closely linked to Justice Clarence Thomas, and at the news showed that he had provided the justice with international luxury trips, paid his grandson's private school tuition, well, his grandnephew, rather, and purchased property from the Thomas family. Leo, co-chairman of the Federalist Society, has been instrumental in efforts to elevate conservative judges to the federal courts. Anybody can say what they want, but me personally, I call it pay for play. We get you in, we put you in these judges' seats, and then you do our bidding. And that's just the truth. Today's subpoenas for Harlan Crow and two individuals that refused to comply with this committee's legislative oversight request for months are at the center of the Supreme Court's epic crisis. This is what Dick Durbin said. Republicans have for months framed the attention of the ethics of the Supreme Court as a partisan response to the court's conservative majority. Lindsey Graham out of South Carolina said, this is all garbage. The top-ranking Republican on the committee. This is just an ongoing effort to destroy the court. Really, Lindsey? You've seen what the court does, and lately you've seen what the court isn't doing. That's being fair to the people of America. They are playing games all day long, period. So Folks, I'm going to tell you honestly, let's get it real. This may be the last honest vote you have for a long time coming up in 2024. If we do not go to the polls strong and go to the polls and take care of business. Now, there are a lot of people out there upset, mad about what's going on in Israel, saying that they're not going to vote. You got a lot of people out here wanting to play the third party game, Dean Phillips and a few others, you know, just to kind of stir things up. And I'll just be honest with you. Over the decades, we've had several third-party candidates run. To this day, none of them have won or even placed second. That's a hint. Do not waste your vote, people. Don't go out there playing little silly games thinking you're going to win some grand prize. Y'all made that mistake back in 2016. And the country is still paying for it. We have a president who's working his butt off trying to repair a lot of damage that was done. And the more he tries to repair, the more many of you cry and whine about what's being done. But yet, many of you are reaping the benefits of what's being done. Might as well tell the truth and shame the devil. A lot of you getting those tax breaks. A lot of you getting those child credits. There are a lot of you getting extra money into your home that you weren't getting under 45. He may have gave you a little temporary stipend, but for the most part, he was making sure that his buddies got it. That 1%. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to call it a night. Let you get back to enjoying your evening, hanging with your family, getting ready to go get into whatever it is that you're getting into. But always remember this, your vote is your voice. Use it and use it wisely. As I always say, each one reach one, teach one. Those of you proficient with your arms, take your folks to the range, get them trained up, get them registered. Start a neighborhood watch, start a cop watch. Watch the people who are watching us. And believe me, folks, we're being watched. Study those sample ballots. Study the people who are running for office, because we do not need any more George Santos rolling in. It is time for us to get America squared away and get back on track. Let's try to make it good for everybody, not just certain people. America is supposed to be a melting pot. Let's stick to that. Quit attacking people because of their sexuality, their race, their political party. Let's grow up and be adults and work on this together, because there are many of us who have more years behind us than in front of us. Let's make this work for the next generations coming along. Everybody have a good evening. Take care of one another. And until next week, I'll holler.